So we're having a fun time looking at the nationalities, by the way, people who work in this rec center. So the average, the most representative is French, but this work actually was done in Duke. But there was a significant curve. So students involved in it were Duke again, and Jewish Madrasa.
Thanks. And then Guillaume Redalé and Eric Clément and Stéphane Luding are, of course, from more senior folk. Okay, so what I'd like to do is take a little quick walk through, and I'm guessing this is a. Is this work? Yeah, ah, okay. So just talking a little bit about some various kinds of models that have been proposed to try to describe forces in dense. Static granular material, which is what we're going to look at, and then move on to two sets of experiments, one of which is one where we're now obtaining vector forces at the particle contacts, and the other using a somewhat older experimental approach to probe what happens if you now have a particular granular packing and you push on it, and then you ask, how does the system respond? Okay, so, all right. So the basic problem that we're trying to deal with is something along the following line. If I write down a stress field, which I might hope to be able to do in general in a granular system, I am left in need of constitutive relations once I've applied the known static balance conditions. So what you would really like to do is, in principle, derive your constitutive relation from a microscopic principle. That's sort of the goal of all this. And so this general problem has generated a cottage industry, particularly in physics, of different kinds of models. So the standard model, okay, in this field, okay, as opposed to other versions of what you call the standard model, is an elastic plastic model. So a granular material responds elastically up to the point where it starts to deform irreversibly, and then it's plastic. Okay, so that's what soil mechanics type models are. That's how they're built. Okay, but then one has a whole host of lattice models, which since they haven't been mentioned, since I've been here, I'll quickly mention some of them and how they work to a little bit, and then some other models which are built not at a truly microscopic level, but by making some intuitive guess, oftentimes based on what force chain structures are supposed to be doing in the mind of the inventor. Okay, so elastoplastic models are continuum models, and all of the important stuff is actually in the momentum equation. So you, of course, are writing down the standard momentum equation, but then putting in, say, a yield surface so that if your shear stresses are stronger than whatever your appropriate normal stress is, then you start to go from an elastic to a plastic description. And once you're in the deforming regime, then you have some rather crazy kinds of stress responses. So this is a sort of a relatively simple soil mechanics version of what happens in the plastic regime, and the shear stress tensor is then zeroth order in the strain rate tensor, which is this famous rate independence.
Do you want a plus sign after that delta?
Let's see. Where are we looking?
First line. Top line.
The top line. Oh, that may well be. Okay. I'm not a strong advocate for these models. So. Anyone here who has stepped on their toes, my apologies. Okay. All right. I gather that not too many people are in this room, but that's okay. So sort of next on my little list here is a model which was proposed by Bouchot and Claudin and perhaps some others whose names aren't springing to my mind right now. But basically the idea is a hypothesized constitutive relation, which then leads actually to a hyperbolic wave-like equation. So the idea is that if you pushed at one point at a granular surface, you would see the forces propagating along a cone in 3D or along a pair of lines in 2D, And then you might throw in perhaps some diffusive behavior on top of that, and you would see the cone or the lines broadening with depth in a diffusive way. Okay. So I think probably everyone here knows the Q model, so I certainly don't need to talk about the detail, but just remind you that if you look in the long wavelength limit, that predicts diffusive behavior in the force or stress propagation. Okay. Convection diffusion is basically this hyperbolic model of diffusion. And one can, in principle, get it out of the lattice model. Just to remind you, so the Claudin-Bouchot group has basically a Q-like model which has vector force properties at each particle, unlike the Q model, which only propagates in 1D. Okay, I think a number of people here heard Josh Sokolar's presentation of the double Y model. So whereas you have something like the OSL model, which is hyperbolic, and a Q model, which is parabolic, now you have a model which is based on what thinks the force chains are doing. So it's a Boltzmann equation for the force chains. But the trick is it, in fact, doesn't have a particular type. And so you can expect that you might see one or two peaks, depending on in particular what depth you're looking for. Okay, which sort of makes it tough on the experimentalists, by the way. Okay. More recently on the scene has actually been spring and ball models. So these are unidirectional springs, typically, a la Isaac Goldhirsch and Chai Goldenberg. So basically the idea is to start with a model where the initial particle interactions are inherently elastic, and then look at some coarse graining of this and try to understand what happens. And so again, there's sort of a long story, and I just want to pull out a little bit here from a paper which just appeared by these two folks a couple of weeks ago. But basically the idea is to try to not only understand whether you get elastic or hyperbolic behavior out of such a system, but to also elucidate the role of friction. So basically, because you put in only elastic forces in the system, you can only get elastic response. But basically the idea is that when you push on this thing, you can generate anisotropy in your system. And that anisotropy, in a limiting case, looks hyperbolic. And then one of the amusing things is that as you increase the friction in this model, so in their model, the friction coefficient is a ratio of effectively a spring constant in the tangential and normal directions. So as you go up in friction, what you find is that you change over increasingly with increasing friction from a two-peak to a single-peak response. But it's always elastic in their picture, and so what they're offering a way of interpreting experiments that I'm going to show you in a bit.
This are in the campaign box.
And so this is a box which is it's basically vertically oriented, say with gravity. Okay, so you put your particles in a box, you let them rain down under gravity and come to rest, and then you apply a point force.
This is called induced anisotropy in the engineering literature.
Indeed, that's what this is. So the idea is that as you increase the friction, then it's harder and harder to induce more anisotropy in the system. And so, by the way, I mean, Isaac lives in an engineering department anyway, and certainly uses that term. At any rate, what they propose is that as a ratio of the strength of the applied force and the size of the friction coefficient, that there is a kind of phase diagram. So for strong forces and weak mu, the anisotropy that you induce leads to a double peak response, but then as you in fact move into a more frictional regime, then you actually see something which looks more like a single peak response characteristic of elasticity.
Right, this is for the ordered packing that you showed in the previous slide?
This is for different cases, right? So the lattice is the ordered packing, and then this is some measure of lattice diversity in the system. Okay, good, okay. Oops, that doesn't belong. Okay, sorry. Finally, the last little piece of theory that I want to remind people of is recent work, which is now not so much addressed to how forces propagate, but what the contact force distribution is. And so there are two offerings here, both invoking a kind of Edwards entropy principle. So the idea is they take a packing of one sort or the other, and the details are not necessarily so important for the moment. They specify that there be at least one contact of force F, and then they count the number of configurations consistent with that relative to some unconstrained number of possibilities, and that gives a P of F. And so then this appeared last year from a group at in the Netherlands, and there's a preprint out from Jos Sokola and company. They're both based on this kind of principle, and the difference between these two, by the way, is the way in which the counting is done. The upshot of this is that if one looks at the force distributions, and these are all frictionless particles, you take this a little bit with a grain of salt if you have real particles, but nevertheless, if one looks at these normal force contacts in compression, then both of these pictures agree that you'll have faster than exponential fall off of the force distribution, something a little bit more Gaussian. And if you shear the system, then you actually stretch out this tail and it begins to look more exponential. Okay, so now what I want to do, okay, having hopefully set the scene, is to see what, I won't say it's quite reality, but let's see what experiments look like. So this is experimentalist hubris, right? Okay. So what I want to do is show you a set of experiments where we prepare particular states of the system, and then we look at the force distributions. And the trick here is that we're going to use photoelasticity in order to find the vector forces at the contacts. And we're going to do this on a large volume of particles so you can get statistically relevant information. So here's the overall scheme of things, right? What I showed you was a biaxial tester where we can move a pair of walls to create arbitrary states of particular stress or deformation. And so just standard biax type idea. And then I'm showing you two sets of images, one for isotropic compression and one for shear, okay? And now what we're going to do is go in, and for each particle, we're going to determine the forces of the contact.
Okay. The system was horizontal, as suggested by your geometry.
Yeah, right. Indeed. So this is sort of looking down at sort of a 45 degree angle from above, and what you might also get out of this is that this is under some sort of computer control, so you can carefully produce whatever state that you want. Okay, so photoelasticity is sort of an old thing, right? I mean, this dates back to Brewster and company or whatever. But the basic principle is that you place your material between cross-circular polarizers, and circular here is the way to go for technical reasons. When you apply forces or deform your photoelastic material, then it becomes birefringent under strain, and you tend to produce patterns which look like this. This is a printer issue, by the way, not a real. So the funny little rectangular things here had to do with the finite resolution of the graphics. Okay. Right. So now you have to use this to get forces out. Okay. And so there are a number of steps. So just quickly, what we do is we'll take an image and actually determine the centers of all the particles in the contacts. And we have to, you know, this is something which really depends on how much money you have to buy the camera. We can't do a system as big as the full system. Rather, we do about 10% of it at a time. So you find the particle centers and contacts. You then use what is sort of a well-defined solution for what happens if I have a disk with arbitrary contact forces at the circumference. Okay, so that's an analytical solution. And basically what we're then doing is we're taking that solution. The solution then determines the photoelastic response. If I give you a set of forces of contacts, that will determine what intensity I would see in the photoelastic image. And now what I want to do is solve the inverse problem for each particle, where we now invoke the fact that force and torque have to be balanced for the particle. Okay, and then we use, after we've gone through and determined each particle individually, we have an error checking which says that adjacent particles with a force contact have to have equal and opposite forces. So that's an error checking mechanism and lets us know that roughly for the moderate to larger forces, we're getting about 5% error, and then it grows to about 10% when we get down to about 1/10 of the mean force. So we stop there.
Can you actually resolve tangential forces, or is
this? No, this is everything. Everything. Okay. So I can take, I take the classical solution, elasticity solution, is you take arbitrary forces, okay, inward, nevertheless, but with tangential forces allowed. Okay, that gives you a particular photoelastic response, okay, and then you're fitting to that model.
Okay.
Yeah, so we actually take multiple images. So the first image is with one but not two polarizers in place. So you get a response, or an image rather, that does not reflect the photoelastic response. You then put the second polarizer in place and take a second image, which gives you the photoelastic data. Okay, the same configuration. So you process the first to get centers and then to check if there's a possible contact. You then look at the photoelastic image to check if potential contacts are really generating any photoelastic response that tells you if you have a contact or not.
Okay. Is the largest source of error? So
the two sources. One is digital resolution, and so really at a contact, elasticity tells you that you should have a divergent density of bands. Okay, so you can't resolve below that. The particles are not perfectly cylindrical. And in addition, if you notice, back here, the response is a function of the wavelength of the light. Okay, so if, in fact, even if you're doing something which is filtered in a fairly narrow band, you're still looking at something which is averaged over some piece of the spectrum. So those are sort of the kinds of errors that get thrown into that. Okay, so then this is sort of before and after pictures. So the original data are these two examples. When you process them by this technique, then this is the kind of image that you can get. And again, we're rejecting forces below a certain level, namely roughly 1/10 of the mean. So certain things that you can actually see in the experimental image are not actually put into the processed image. But again, that's at 1/10 of f-bar or smaller. Okay, we can probably, if you look in here, you can probably see some of these contacts for Fred's question where the forces are clearly not normal. Okay, so what comes out of this? The two Edwards entropy models were for frictionless particles, but we clearly do have friction. And when we look at the force distributions, we then measure the tangential forces in both cases actually to be always exponential. Okay, so here's shear, here's compression. You could also look at any state in between. And the tangential forces are always exponentially distributed. But interestingly enough, the normal forces change from what you one had in the, say, this is a case of isotropic compression, which looks very much like the isotropic case for the Edwards entropy models. And as you shear the system, you populate this tail. So that actually is I think quite consistent with the with these two models. Another piece of data which is of interest. Oh, let me make one more comment, by the way. So the actual magnitude of the tangential forces is rather small in these systems, even though the particles are pretty frictional. So the mean tangential force is about 1/10 of the mean normal force, and the tangential forces fall in the distribution well below the normal forces. Which is to a certain extent played out when you look at distributions of mobilization. So you see that there are actually a lot of contacts for which the ratio of the shear or the tangential force to the normal force divided by the friction coefficient is a big population of those. As you go closer and closer to frictional failure, that distribution drops off. There's not much difference between these two guys, and they both seem to have a little bump. So there's a slight overpopulation of particles which are very close to slipping. Okay. All right. So a little more.
Are you suggesting that no particles have really slipped at this point?
Well, no. I mean, so some particles, particularly when you sheared it, clearly some particles have slipped. Okay. So, but they're then presumably moved into the. So those particles have presumably moved on up into here.
You say shear. How far do you shear? What's the magnitude of the shear?
Let's see. Right. Okay. So this data is for a shear of 4%. Okay. Actually, these distributions are very insensitive to the amount. So if you look at data for a 1 or 2%, they basically look the same. The compression. This is an example where the compression is only about 1.5%. Okay. Now the question is, how anisotropic is the system? Okay, as Jim was pointing out, what role is anisotropy playing here? These are now contact angles for the shear and compressed systems, and this is only for forces at or above the mean. Okay, so what you see is in the sheared case, there is a very strong population of contacts which are now along the direction of the force chains. It's not quite horizontal because the biax actually compresses only in, or actually moves only in two directions, and that actually means that there's a slight imperfection associated with that that tilts the force chains relative to the parallel and perpendicular directions of the biax. Interestingly, this is a bidisperse system. It doesn't have any obvious really long-range order, but if you now look at the distribution of contact angles, it really has this extraordinarily strong hexagonal symmetry floating in.
Is that significant? It's actually lined up with 90 and 30. If you do it again, it won't.
I think possibly. I mean, that's a good question. I'm not sure. It seems like it shouldn't, but. If you now do a slightly different measure, so that was, if you like, really geometric anisotropy. This is really more a measure now of the mechanical or force anisotropy. So the idea is now you start in the center of your system and you simply make an angular bin and you see how much force, the magnitude of the mean normal force that you encounter in a given angular bin. And in the shear case, you see this sort of doubly, or what, super harmonic response as you go around the circle. So in fact, you have a very strong amount of force localization into the force chain direction. If you look in the case of the compressed system, in fact, even though you seem to have the structural symmetry, the force symmetry is in fact more or less lacking, and this is more like within the scatter, this looks basically random.
Shouldn't it be periodic just because of the definition of shouldn't there be a symmetry around pi?
Hopefully there's, well, there is, I think. Is there? Well, let's see, that's a good question.
Distinguish
No, oh, no, I think not. So it doesn't, yeah. I think it's not there for the following reason, that if you now take your image like this, and you now divide it up into angular bins like that, there's no reason to have symmetry. Right? If you made your bins like that, then of course you would have to have the symmetry if you rotated around pi. But it's really, it's this one and not the full double cone.
And which particles do we average over, apart from the boundaries?
Okay. That's a good question. So the actual piece that we're looking at is a 10% more or less dead center in the middle of the sample, right? So you're as far away from the boundaries as we can, quote, get.
Do you notice any variation if you look somewhere
else? Not done systematically, so it's an excellent question, but sort of somewhere down on our to-do list. Okay. Now, what I think is actually more... what I think is particularly interesting is to say, well, okay, you know, the classic problem is how do you characterize force chains, okay, which is not such a trivial thing. I think everybody I know who's tried to take an image, either computed or determined experimentally, and determine force chains, sort of comes up with a standard reaction, which is to say, you know, this is really arbitrary. So here's a more well-defined, I think, way to get a measure of sort of the longevity of force chains, and that's simply to compute the average magnitude of forces on a particle. So you take all the forces on a given particle, you take their magnitude and average them. So that gives you a scalar for each particle, and now you look at the ordinary correlation function of this, but you don't average over directions. Okay, so standard density type correlation function, maintaining directional information. And if you look in the sheared system along the chain direction, okay, then not surprisingly you see that correlation is maintained over a much longer distance. Okay, this is basically our... this guy peters out from something roughly power law-like at the limit at which we can calculate, right? So we compute the correlation function by a Fourier method, and this is basically the Nyquist cutoff. If you look perpendicular to the force chains, this thing falls off extremely rapidly. So on a scale of a couple of particles, it's fallen through the basement. And if you look in the compressed system, then both directions for the correlation function are equivalent, and they both fall off roughly as fastly. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Okay.
Did you say it's the mean of mod f for each particle, or the sum of mod f?
No, it's the mean. It's a mean of...
Then if you have a very weak... If you've got an indeterminate contact which is close to zero, that's going to affect it a lot because you're dividing through by
the... Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, so the general approach is certainly not unique. Okay, you could think of other schemes. You could take the maximum or whatever.
So
did
you try just the sum of that rather than dividing it by the
number? No, I mean, this actually has... So it actually is the mean. Yeah, I mean, in principle, it might be a problem. I'm not sure. It's an interesting thing to think about. All right. So that's so much for that. And let's see. So let me do a quick walkthrough. And so it's sort of in the spirit of half-hour talks. I'll run over some. Okay. But I think it might be interesting to this group to talk about what one sees if one now takes a particular system and pushes on it and tries to relate that response to the various models that are out there. So the scenario now will be just a little bit different. Now we're doing nearly vertical packings of particles, so gravity gets folded into this. But the charm of that is we're preparing the packings by leaning them up against a nearly but not quite vertical glass plate. So there's now no longer any friction of substance with the plate, i.e. between the particles and the plate. So that piece is totally removed as any source of experimental contamination. And so now when we push, of course, well, we're pushing against a network which has a gravitational hydrostatic effect. Okay. And the other thing which is different about the experiments is that we did these in an earlier life where instead of actually doing the inverse problem on every particle, which is really quite a bit of work involved in that, rather what we do is we take images like this, which are false colored. These are for tracking the solid bars. And we notice that at a contact that the forces actually cause this, and this is, even though it's rather pretty, it doesn't show you the best resolution, but you get an increasing density of bands as the force increases. And for Fred's benefit, that's clearly a non-normal force. So then what we do is we have a calibration which relates the applied force to a sample. So we take a small number of these things, we squish them in a highly controlled way, and then we compute the integral over the particle of the intensity gradient square. And you can then calibrate that rather nicely with the force per length. And so one test is, do you get more or less a hydrostatic head? So if you have a pile of these things and look at the average value of this measure of the force per particle, then you find that that's roughly linear, as you would expect. Okay, so we've switched. We're still using photoelasticity, but these are now some measure of the mean force. Okay, so now if you push on one of these networks, okay, then you get some mishmash of, so that's the force response, but it's also superposed on a gravitational head effect, which is why there are force chains at the bottom. Okay, so, all right. So this is a slightly clearer picture of what happens. So this is before you push. This is after you push, okay? And by the way, and in the real life, these are all monochrome, right? Okay, so nature, these are false color to give you a sense of the actual scale of the forces involved. So now what you'd like to do is remove the hydrostatic part and look at what was the actual response. You take the difference of the G-squared images. And so every time you do it, of course, you get a different. If you stir up the thing a little bit, you get a different response. And in fact, so what you might like to do then is to ask what's the mean response. And so this is the mean response for hexagonal packing of disks using, so this is an ensemble of 50 trials, all superposed to make a false color image. But if you actually look at the response as a function of depth, you start off with this black data, which is sitting up here close to the top. And what you see is that it broadens along something with two peaks, which is sort of either anisotropic elasticity or hyperbolic, depending on your what your flavor of the month is. There is a central peak in here, by the way, which is not in anybody's model that I'm aware of yet, ever. But that's a well.
Can you just remind me what they're called, colors?
So the up here, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so red is the strongest response, and then turning yellow to blue.
Does that just measure can that ever?
Does view we seek decompression? Sure. Okay. So in other words, if you say you push here and you push particles out somewhere else, it is sensitive to that because you're looking at the change in the image from.
But it would show up the same way. It would show up the same signature as a positive compression. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. In principle, no. I mean, it should. I mean, you really have a number which is a positive number, inherently positive, and when you take the difference, it can be negative. So in this system, that's a very, very small fraction of particles that you actually see any decreases. So I mean, in principle, it's there, okay? But I think statistically, it's sufficiently rare that you don't see it in the system anymore.
You could also decompress the system somehow by pulling on one particle upwards.
We could pull it on it upwards, and that's not something we've done, right? So, I think an even more interesting experiment would be one where you actually push on a particle in the middle, because then you will be compressing in one direction, but but relaxing forces in the other.
Can I just also ask you, is the integrated incremental stress, is that well conserved when we track these?
Yeah, so I mean, it's within error bar. Okay. But as a reminder, okay, of sort of just how much change you get between different realizations, right? So in these experiments, we actually keep the same nominal geometric packing, but we literally massage it to rearrange every frictional contact. So you haven't grossly changed the lattice at all, but every time you do it, you do get a different response. And now, if you simply look here at the ratio of the RMS, pointwise RMS to the pointwise mean, so in this ensemble, you get something where the mean value of that ratio is 2. Okay, so you know, well, all right. If you're really thinking in terms of a continuum description at this scale, you might want to think again. Okay.
Have you tried with the tilted thing so that the lattice structure is not horizontal?
Not in this case. Okay. So
would it change?
I mean, is it sensitive to the orientation of the lattice structure? Let me show you something in a bit which I think will address that, which is the other way to get around that is not to apply a normal force. Okay, and so we'll take a look at that in just a bit. Okay, so depending on people's patience and whatever, let me just go through a number of different probes of this kind of system. Okay, so historically, for instance, things like the three-leg model, okay, which was predicting a convection diffusion equation, was claiming that the response of the system should be strongly influenced by the amount of order or disorder in the system. Well, that can come either from geometric order, or it can come from the fact that real particles have frictional contacts for which there can be an indeterminate frictional force, right? So you have two brands of disorder floating around in your system if you're not at an isostatic, in the isostatic case, which we never are in these experiments. So this is our most disordered system, which we made by cutting up pentagonal particles, right? Okay. So this is a system where there's no long-range orientational order in the system. Of course, you have frictional disorder as well. And this thing has a force response on average, which is a big blob. Okay, so then the question is, what does a big blob mean? So you might say, well, this kind of looks like what would happen if I pushed on an elastic sheet. Okay, so there's a standard Boussinesq solution for the force response of an elastic sheet. Or you might say, well, you know, maybe it's diffusive. So you need to have a quantitative check of some kind to be able to distinguish these two types of responses. So if this were pure isotropic elasticity, if I pushed gently on the top, then I would see stresses which are, in fact, simple inverse power laws, and they have the scaling property that the width of this response depends linearly on the depth z. So x is the horizontal coordinate, z is the depth, and for any stress component you pick, you should see linear scaling of this stress response with depth. So the idea is then to compute the width of the response, and then to check to see how it varies with depth. Okay, so here's the width of that force data that I just showed you, response data for the pentagons, and so from the scale of a particle and up, that response is very close to linear. Okay, so this is at least marginally consistent, maybe more than marginally consistent, with linear elasticity, isotropic linear elasticity.
It's still a system, though, that shows chains clearly in one of your...
Right. Any one of these things has... you have chains all over the place. And when you push, it clearly follows some subset of the network on down. Okay. So now, moving back towards the more ordered case, you can make bidisperse systems in which, okay, so, oh, let's not worry about A's. So these are bidisperse with more or less of a minority species of particles, let's say. And so if you're almost monodisperse, you still see a remnant of these two peaks. But as you move even remotely towards a truly bidisperse system, then you see that double peak totally disappear.
Can I just ask you about the peaks? These are peaks over averages of...
These are always over averages. So if you...
Also, say, is the width of an individual, if you're
Right. Good. Okay, so the average of the width. So if you take... So is there a reason to think that would be different?
Well, I mean, you could have each one be very narrow, but pointing in different directions.
Yeah. So it's not something we've actually done, and that's certainly an interesting thing to ask. My gut reaction is to say that in some sense these things tend to be actually relatively wide, but what you tend to get is a small number of chains, but sort of distributed over a relatively broad range of angles. So I think that this probably is not too far off the mark from what you would see in some responses, but not every response. So some of them will actually be, you know, actually rather narrow. And so you really have a distribution of width. Okay, so that's, we don't need to beat on that. So the other way that you can actually get more order into your system is to reduce the number of redundant contacts. And so nature doesn't normally let you do that very happily, but you can force it to do that by essentially placing a template at the bottom of the stack and then creating layer by layer a square packing. So now this is one where the number of potential contacts per particle has been reduced to four. Okay.
Anisotropic to begin with.
Only marginally so, right? Okay. So I mean, it has the square directions, but.
Well, I would say that cubic symmetry is discernible in continuum elasticity. Hexagonal is not.
Right. Okay. In that sense, it is right. And so now, if you look at the response of this, okay. So when you have the hexagonal packing, you tend to propagate on average down the lattice directions, right? Okay, which is by the way not what the hyperbolic models would necessarily predict. Okay, they don't claim that you should go down the lattice direction, but that's in fact slightly more in flavor of this induced anisotropy, which then favors the lattice direction. But nevertheless, if you reduce the number of contacts, you go from a hexagonal mean response, which penetrates to some given depth, and then in the almost square lattice, it actually penetrates significantly deeper. And then, if you then are very patient, this is maybe why it's good to have a Chinese student or something, I don't know, and wrap all your particles with Teflon, okay? So now what you've done is reduced more the frictional disorder of the contact. So here you have just the original frictional particles. Here you have more slippery particles. And again, you're now propagating much deeper into the down the lattice directions. Okay. So now, back to your question. What happens if we take one of these packings? So this is a hexagonal disk packing. And now we start to push not normally in the direction of gravity, but tangentially. Then actually something rather amusing comes up. So you see an effect which tells you that friction is playing a role. So as you tilt the angle, So you're pushing at an ever increasing angle this way, and eventually, when you make that angle sufficiently inclined, you find, in fact, even here, you start to pick up an extra little peak in the response, okay? So that's not something you can get with frictionless particles, right? Okay, because what you're actually doing is you're now propagating down not the principal vectors of the lattice, but actually sort of the next nearest neighbor lattice vectors. So if you then average over angular windows, as we did actually in that previous discussion, and what you find is that as you tilt the angle from normal down towards 30, you start to pick up an extra peak at the next nearest lattice orientation, which is presumably due because you've got particles which the static friction, which can twist and then transfer some of that stress to the particle which they both touch. Okay, all right. With pentagons, that effect is in fact not particularly obvious, although you don't have a lattice, so you don't expect that to occur. But you do see something in the pentagon solution, which is kind of interesting. So here the idea is that if this really disordered system has a response which is modeled pretty well by isotropic elasticity, then you ought to be able to apply that same solution regardless of the tilt angle. And so it's because it's a simple scaling solution, it's easy to collapse, to take all the data at a given angle and collapse it as a function of depth for whatever angle you're pushing. And so the agreement here between classical elasticity-like solutions for the normal force is actually very good. It actually starts to fall apart more and more on sort of one edge, presumably because now you are opening contacts on that edge, and that stops being elastic on the backside. Okay. And now let's see. So we're one last comment. If you try to do this same kind of experiment on a system that's been subjected to shear, and in this case we're going to do simple shear, well, first what happens is the act of shearing produces now a network, a strong network, which is tilted at 45 degrees. Okay, and it's tilted at 45 degrees because simple shear is actually corresponds to compression along this direction, dilation that way, and a rotation. Okay, so this is in some sense equivalent to the pure shear type states that I showed you earlier. And once again, if you look at this force correlation function, the same type of critter, then it has a strong response. So more or less parallel-like response along the force chain direction and a delta function-like response in the transverse direction. But now when you push, the system knows that it has this strong anisotropy in it. And so now the elastic response, if I push normally, actually bends along the force chain direction, which presumably is something which ought to be extractable from anisotropic elasticity as well, which becomes much more of an issue, right? Because now you have many more parameters in your elastic model. So that's a little bit of a pain, and so not something we've pursued yet. Okay, so let's see, I think it's probably all. Okay, so some quick conclusions. First of all, if you simply look at the force distributions, then you can tell something about the state that you're working in, whether it's been sheared or compressed or not. But perhaps most interestingly, I think, is, well, one of the more interesting things is you really do have a suggestion of long-range correlations along the strong force chain direction of sheared systems. Really what the experiments show is that whether you believe that they're elastic or not, which is probably the most likely explanation, there is a strong effect from order to disorder. Presumably that's something which one can capture in something like a sort of a local elastic model a la Goldhirsch. But you can't totally throw out, a hyperbolic picture, I'd say, quite yet. So at any rate, that's sort of where things stand at the moment. Yeah.
In the straight up Pentagon packings, where it looked like the isotropic elasticity solution is working, have you checked if maybe there's a depth in the pile below which individual realizations actually look like isotropic elasticity?
So that's sort of on the list, right? The problem is that the deeper you go, okay, the harder it gets to actually characterize these responses. But it's not out, you know, it's really not out of reach. And that's sort of the obvious test that you would do given, you know, the Goldenberg-Goldhirsch response, which says that as you go deeper, it will start to look more and more elastic.
What about comparing stuff with GM simulations?
I'd love to. Okay, yeah, no is the answer.
It seems to me the question is, to what extent do the force chains have to be resolved? Is the notion of induced anisotropy sufficient, or must they be followed in more detail?
Right, and the answer is it sort of depends at what level you're looking, right? So if you really look at individual responses, it's really responding in very particular ways along the lattice, or whatever structure you have. Now, back to Craig's question, what would happen if you look deeply enough? Would you eventually get to a point where, in any realization, you wouldn't see things sort of propagating along a tangle, but you really see something which is more homogeneous looking? So at that level, I think the answer is we don't know. If you then say, well, suppose I look at some ensemble average, okay, then for sure you don't need to worry about the force chains per se. They've disappeared. But that's not, you know, that's not what you really do. If you're an engineer, you don't say, oh, gee, I'm gonna look at an ensemble, and that's, you know, what's important.
The engineering system will typically involve many more particles too.
But that's the question of, well, if you look deep enough, you know, what is it like? Okay, so I think, right.
Frankly, you try to do two kinds of flows, one after the other.
Different places to see what correlation is.
Yeah, also to see the history effect.
You mean if you push and then let it go and push again? Yeah. So all of these are done in such a way that we throw out any ones which are not reversible. So these are only reversible experiments. That's the majority of them are reversible. So when you push on them and let them go, you recover the same force network. Well, no, that's not so obvious. Okay, so we've tried that, and the answer is not conclusive, right? That's really a question of, are you inducing anisotropy in your system by the action of testing? And so the answer is we're not sure, okay? And that's going to require just a whole lot more testing to be confident. Right. Yeah, so the question is, you push here and then push here, is that the same as pushing here and pushing there, or pushing at the same time? And if you're a strong advocate of induced anisotropy, you say those are different, potentially.
You're working in a limit where your stress is rather small.
Yeah. So the idea is...
In that linear limit, it ought to be additive.
Right, so you're hoping that you're sufficiently linear that they are additive. Okay, so the question is, can you see a point at which that goes away?
But you could also ask the question, is there truly a linear machine?
Yeah.
Right.
It could be that with extremely modest forces, you know, break a few contacts.
Yeah.
And all bets are off.
Because the down under the interactions are fundamentally very nonlinear.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we do. Okay. So what we try to do is empirically determine whether we are in a linear limit by, say, let's see if we can go back then. Yeah, okay, so for instance, if we look along, say, that direction, okay, and increase the applied force, okay, then you can have some measure as a function of, you know, how is the mean force along a particular direction dependent on the applied force. And we tried to work in a regime which appeared to be sort of at the limit of where empirically it stopped being linear. But that doesn't mean that that at some much smaller force we haven't already departed from true linearity. So.
Yeah,
What seems is that linear, in that sense, is different from linear superposition.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, if it's truly, you would hope that those are the same, right?
I want to go back to Jim's question, because it seems like in the response function, you're seeing that the force chains are actually supporting propagation on the force.
Right.
But the force chains, you can have a complicated network and have it still be an elastic.
Right. So it's elastic at some scale.
Yeah, so resolving the force chains and determining whether they're elastic,
well, right. So.
How would you make that resolution, even if you did say the force chains are critical?
Right.
So
how do you decide if it's diffusive or not? Okay, if I give you a single image? Right, I mean, so what you... It started to be a really tough thing to resolve experimentally, but what I would imagine you would want to do is suppose you were not limited by resolution. And now I push, and I see, okay, yes, certain force chains are now bearing the brunt of this, but as they go deeper, then the force chains start to split and so forth. And now if I look in a single image at the rate of splitting, that ought to tell me whether this thing is diffusive-like or whether it's something else. But I think that means, I'm not even sure you can see that computationally, let alone in an experiment. If then, you might have to look. Well, okay, so in Jim's engineering limit where you've got millions of particles and stuff like that.
If it's hyperbolic, it has to be localized disturbance as opposed to diffusive connectivity.
That's right. So if it's hyperbolic, then what you have is some unique set of force chains which don't split. Okay, so they become the characteristics if you believe Rafi Blumenfeld, and you can follow them in a totally reversible way from one side to the other. Right. Yeah, David.
I was also wondering, I would have thought that if they're kind of soft, then you're going to be hyperstatic in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these are always hyperstatic.
And so I guess, kind of along the argument that I mentioned, I would have thought that you're likely to find yourself in elastic. Would you agree with that?
I think this, so I would say that the best description to date is an elastic one. I don't think you can really argue very convincingly that anything is really hyperbolic. But I think if you're really honest, you have to say, have we proved that the hyperbolic models are wrong? And I think the answer is no, you really haven't proved that either. Okay. But the weight, I think, of the evidence is that it's elastic.